Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Delaware River is under pressure, endangered fish are struggling, oxygen levels are dropping, and utilities are fighting stricter EPA rules. Meg McGuire of Delaware Currents explains what's really going on. Two friends have logged thousands of miles across America on two wheels. We'll find out what's driving their journey for peace. And the latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast, drops today. We'll have a preview of host Tom Candela's chat with five-time Emmy-nominated playwright and screenwriter Douglas Carter Bean about his new show, Finding Dorothy Parker. And a new dual exhibit opening at the Wayne County Arts Alliance, Culture reporter Valerie Manzi takes us inside. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The White House says it's taking back an additional $4.9 billion in foreign aid, using a method known as a pocket rescission. That means the request to cancel funds comes too late in the fiscal year for Congress to weigh in, effectively sidestepping lawmakers' control over spending. Stocks on Wall Street opened lower this morning as the Commerce Department reported a modest jump in core inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow was down 108 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in July were up 2.6% from a year ago, according to the Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve. Stripping out volatile food and energy costs, core inflation was 2.9%, up slightly from the 12 months ending in June. Flood damage at an Indiana oil refinery caused a temporary spike in gas prices this month, but prices are settling down again heading into the holiday weekend. The Federal Reserve is widely expected to lower its benchmark interest rate in about 2.5 weeks. It's not clear whether Fed Governor Lisa Cook will take part in that meeting. President Trump sought to fire Cook this week, but Cook is fighting her dismissal as an unlawful attack on the central bank's independence. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The ousted head of the CDC says she's still fighting her dismissal. The White House says Susan Menarez was removed for not aligning with the administration's agenda, including new directives from the health secretary. Former acting CDC director Richard Besser says he spoke with Menarez about why she refused to go along.
There were two lines. One is that she would never do anything that was illegal, and the other was that she would never do anything that flew in the face of science, and she was being asked to do both of those things.
Menarez says the only person who can fire her is President Trump and says she still hasn't heard from him. Two firefighters have been arrested by Border Patrol this year while working to contain one of Washington State's largest blazes. Gustavo Sagrero from member station KUOW has more.
David Buenos Diaz is a crew boss leading one of a few freelancer teams combating the Bear Gulch fire. Diaz was there when he saw Border Patrol arresting the two firefighters. The teams he works with are composed of visa workers from Mexico, U.S. citizens, and members of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation.
Everybody works, you know, no matter what ethnicity you are. We're all there for the same thing. We're all there to help the communities out, help the forest, and, you know, just protect and serve.
The morning of the arrest, Diaz says the lead fire management team sent the men out to cut wood. That's when Border Patrol came to check in on the workers and arrested the two men. For NPR, I'm Gustavo Sagrero in Seattle.
This is NPR News. Tariffs on small packages from around the world take effect today under a new executive order from President Trump. Until now, shipments valued under $800 could enter the U.S. duty-free. That changed earlier this year for packages from China and Hong Kong, and now the same rules apply everywhere else. Packages will now face tariffs and inspection. The White House says the move closes a loophole that let foreign shippers dodge tariffs and slip counterfeit goods and drugs into the country. Scientists are sticking out their necks about how we consider giraffes. The world's tallest land mammal was once believed to be a single species. But as NPR's Amy Held reports, giraffes are now recognized as four species.
Turns out giraffes are turning heads for a new reason. This month, the International Union for Conservation of Nature announced four distinct giraffe species. They are the northern giraffe, reticulated giraffe, Maasai giraffe, and the southern giraffe, all living in different African regions, woodlands, and grasslands. And while scientists had already recognized subspecies, they say those unique settings and careful study of giraffes' genetic differences and bone structure informed the change. The group says a more nuanced understanding of the animals can help with their conservation, as giraffes face threats like habitat loss, climate change, and poaching. Amy Held, NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, usually joins us at this time on Fridays, but he's off today and we'll catch up with him next week. So instead, we're bringing you the latest reporting on the Delaware River from Meg McGuire of Delaware Currents. Public water utilities are appealing to the Trump administration for a last-minute reprieve from new federal rules that would raise water quality standards for a section of the Delaware River that are set to be finalized next month. The EPA proposed new standards to improve water quality, but public water providers are pushing back, arguing the costs are too high and the science uncertain. Additionally, oxygen levels in the Delaware River are too low to support endangered fish like the Atlantic sturgeon, and regulators say wastewater discharges from Philadelphia to Wilmington are a big reason why. Radio Catskill's Patricio Robayo spoke with Meg McGuire, who's covered the Delaware River for years, about what's driving this debate, what's at stake for the communities who depend on the river, and what solutions might keep it healthy for generations to come.
The thing that we're looking at with these rules is dissolved oxygen. Up in the river where you guys are, there's no problem with dissolved oxygen. There's very little demand on oxygen. All the fish that are up there have enough oxygen to survive, clearly. You know, your robust trout fishery is an example of, and they are a very sensitive species to how much dissolved oxygen. And just to make sure that people are know this, fish just like us need oxygen to survive, except they breathe it through the oxygen that's dissolved in the water. As you move your way down, move down the river, things can get more troubling. They really only start getting troubled for this particular problem, Trenton and maybe a little further south. The problem here is there's not enough dissolved oxygen in the river to support a particular fish, the endangered sturgeon. And how this happens is essentially way back in the day when the Clean Water Act was first issued and the Delaware River started paying attention to itself and the DRBC was founded, in fact, before the Clean Water Act. One of the first things they wanted to tackle was the dirty, smelly river, because back then it was a dirty, smelly river. Again, not so much where you are, but certainly further south. There are two things that can make, that can contribute to a dirty, smelly river. And I'm sorry to be so blunt here, but it's poop and it's pee, right? The river can take care of quite a lot of the processing of both those things in a very natural progression, a very natural changing from certain sorts of compounds to healthier compounds, if there's enough oxygen in the river. The further south you go, because now there's a lot of poo and pee in the river, the worse it got. When they first addressed it and they started creating wastewater treatment plants, the big offender was the poop. So the wastewater treatment plants really took that in hand and made an enormous difference in the river, which is why the river doesn't smell bad anymore, no matter where you are, right? But the thing that was left out was the effect of our pee. Once you get south of Trenton, the wastewater treatment plants end up putting more nitrogen in the river than the river can process. Wastewater treatment plants above Trenton put nitrogen in the water, but the river can process it and it moves on. There's so much nitrogen in the water from basically not enough processing being done with RP, that there is less dissolved oxygen in the river then actually it's not great for many fish, but it's especially bad for the sturgeon, which is an endangered species.
Right.
So the Delaware River Basin Commission, now it's more than 10 years ago, took up the study of the Delaware to try and find out what needed to be done. Now, when the Delaware River Basin Commission looks at the river as a whole, and of course the Delaware River Basin Commission, just to remind your listeners, is composed of the four states that surround the Delaware. Essentially, the commissioners themselves are the governors of those four states. Now, the governors don't often actually appear at the meetings. Their representative does. So the governors of the four states gave the Delaware River Basin Commission the authority to adjudicate some of the issues on the river, and one of them was the water quality. The Delaware River Basin Commission divided the river into six zones and a couple of sub-zones. The zone one up by you, and then zone six is way down in the bay. The troubled area is zones of 3, 4, and the top of 5, which is essentially the urban area from a little bit above Philadelphia to below Wilmington. For those zones, they established a water quality standard for dissolved oxygen. In the upper river, it was one thing. In this troubled area, it was another thing. And in the bay, it was yet another thing. The dissolved oxygen standards were lowered in that troubled area. And those lower dissolved oxygen standards, though the wastewater treatment plants were meeting them, were still not enough to allow for healthy propagation of the Atlantic sturgeon, again, an endangered species. So you have two big overarching principles. You have the Clean Water Act that wants to make the waters of the United States swimmable and fishable. And then you have the zone standards set by the DRBC, which is the four states.
Right.
It's the discussion of these standards that has been a thorn in the side of regulators and people who are concerned about the river for many, many years. In fact, it probably predates the 10-year conversation that the DRBC has been having about it, because people have been seeing that they have evidence that some species are not doing well. The species that seems to have the most problem, again, is the Atlantic sturgeon, and the time of the Atlantic sturgeon's life, the juveniles, those are the ones that have a real problem. Now, back in the day, before they had any standards, there was like a black hole of oxygen deprivation in the river that none of the river fish that would normally go up the river to spawn could get through it.
Yeah.
That has gone away. There's often all those fish that want to go upriver can usually pass through. The young of the species might have a difficult time, especially during the summer. So the DRBC was looking at this for 10 years. It was taking a long time. The DRBC is a fabulous institution, but they work slowly. But that's, you know, they're basically dealing with four separate states that have their own issues. Anyway, they were coming close to a conclusion. Many environmental advocates, including and most forcefully the Delaware Riverkeeper, decided that the DRBC wasn't moving fast enough. So they petitioned the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to take over this zone, the problem of the zones and what the standards were. To everyone's surprise, the EPA agreed. And so now the problem is in the EPA's lap. But then the EPA didn't move fast enough for the Delaware Riverkeeper. So the Delaware Riverkeeper took the EPA to court for not moving fast enough. In the meantime, okay, so trying to get a mathematical picture here. Generally, the standard for these zones was around the 3.5 milligrams per liter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which was perhaps too low for the Delaware Atlantic sturgeon to thrive. Okay. The EPA came out with a possible standard. This is now probably 2 years ago, of 5.6 or 5.7. That is a huge jump. And the burden of creating water that meets that quality will fall on the wastewater treatment plants. Remember the beginning of the story is the wastewater treatment plants are not doing enough with the amount of nitrogen that ends up passing through them and into the river. But in order for the wastewater treatment plants to process that water to that degree, they need to spend a lot of money. And when you look at the towns, the municipalities that are most affected by this new standard, these are not very rich communities. It's Camden, it's Wilmington, it's Philadelphia, and there's other water treatment, wastewater treatment plants in amongst that, in that corridor. And they are facing, like, their communities are not rich. They don't have really deep pockets. Then they're facing also new legislation that demands them to replace lead service lines and a host of other things. So in my, the way I look at it is this is like a rock and a hard place.
Right.
It's very hard to ask those communities to spend that money, to turn around and ask their citizens to pay more money for water. Because, like, generally speaking, people think, oh, well, rain falls from the sky, it should be free. No, they have to ask their residents to pay more money to be able to make these improvements. And this has been essentially a pushback of a lot of the wastewater treatment facilities in the watershed and, in fact, in other places across the country. How they can pay for those improvements and all the other things without having a significant impact on water rates. The people who are most anxious to get those rates up, the zones, the quality, water quality up to a higher standard, believe we should just go ahead and, you know, make new rules and make the wastewater treatment plants spend whatever money they have to in order to get there. I'm a little like, oh, yeah, that's not good, really, because I don't necessarily want to put more money, take more money out of the pockets of people who live in otherwise, you know, not very wealthy cities, right? So there's a real friction here. The Delaware Riverkeeper, okay, if we think the standard now is about 3.5, the Delaware Riverkeeper would prefer a standard of 6.3. The recent, 2 years ago, EPA suggested proposed increases. And the standard then that the EPA proposed was, oh, Lord, I had it up and now it's not on my screen. It was somewhere around 5.6, 5.7. So it's not quite double. It's double if you go by the Delaware Riverkeeper. It's a little less than double the way the EPA was thinking. Now, the other thing about the EPA standards was it was variable. Different times of year was different levels of dissolved oxygen.
Right.
They were looking to create a rich oxygen environment when the juveniles were just coming out and about. They're sort of young of year, and what do they need in order to survive? With all the lawsuits back and forth, what we had recently was a judge basically saying, you have to have new standards by a certain point in time.
Right.
The municipal folks are pushing back against the proposed standard. And they're suggesting a standard of 4.5. We don't know yet which way the EPA is going to jump on this. As we have seen for many other environmental regulations, the EPA are loosening many of the regulations, and it is possible that they might agree to what the modified water quality standard would be. So instead of getting, okay, we were at 3.5, the Delaware Riverkeeper was looking at 6.3, the EPA's among, you know, sort of a sliding scale, but say the EPA's decision was the proposal that they had that they opened up for public comment, as I said, I think about a year and a half ago, was about 5.6. But we're looking at now is possibly a 4.5 milligrams of oxygen. So it's an improvement, but it's not nearly to the level that river advocates are concerned about. So, and the way that this, the story that we wrote about it is sort of framing it all in a judge's decision, he's basically said that the two parties need to come to an agreement, and if not by a certain date, I think it's September 22nd, he will rule the judge will just rule, because enough of this nonsense. We have to have a decision one way or the other. And the truth of the matter is, it seems, I don't know if it seems unlikely, it certainly seems unlikely to me that the Riverkeeper is going to be happy with a significant lowering of what they hoped were proposed standards. But I don't know. We have to sort of wait and see until perhaps September 22nd and see if they've come to a resolution. And if not, will the judge take it over? And if the judge takes it over, when he'll come up with his decision.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's always fascinated me about, obviously, the Delaware generally, but certainly this story indicates the complexity of keeping our water as good as it needs to be, both for us and for the fish and for our drinking water. Because, of course, our drinking water goes through a process. Every time there's a wastewater treatment on the river and in the tributaries, they take in our used water, improve it up to whatever the EPA standards are, and then release it into the river for the next bunch of people to take it and treat it and use it and put it back in the river. So it's like this Archimedes screw of water that's always going downriver, right? So how safe it is to drink has a lot to do with our regulations.
Right.
Now, the water that we're talking about here, or this particular standard, will not change the safety of our water to drink. But it does have some impact on how vibrant the river is, how much it supports the aquatic life. That all points to a healthy river.
And we got more with Meg McGuire of Delaware Currents about the Delaware River and the last-minute reprieve that public water utilities are appealing to the Trump administration for these new federal rules. We'll have more of this conversation after a break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Jason Dole, reminding you Radio Catskills Music Yard Sale is tomorrow, 10 to 3, right here at Radio Catskill Studios. If you're looking for vinyl, we've got it. Records, LPs, 45s, 78s, plus audio equipment, turntables, cassette decks, reel-to-reels, and CDs, cassettes, 8-tracks, everything musical, price to move. Something here is meant for you. Cash or Venmo accepted at the Radio Catskill Music Yard Sale. Don't miss it. 10 to 3 tomorrow at Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Let's return to our conversation with Meg McGuire, editor of Delaware Currents, the nonprofit online news magazine dedicated to the Delaware River. Patricia Ravallo is speaking to her about the EPA's proposed new standards to improve water quality, but how public water providers are pushing back, arguing the costs are too high and the science uncertain.
One thing I was questioning is sort of the motives of some of the utility companies. The public utility companies are pushing back against these regulations. When I attend planning town board meetings and we hear like the local, water superintendent, wastewater superintendent, always gripe about new regulations that come out, only because a lot of times it's either outdated equipment that's serving the district, or just this additional more work they have to do. So what are the utilities are usually mostly worried about? Is it about the money or the technical challenges in meeting these new standards?
I think it's a significant challenge in meeting the new standards. I mean, I'm sure there are some bad guys and gals who run water departments, because there's some bad guys and gals who run everything. But the vast majority of people that I have met who work in water departments would be happy to make the water as clean as it's possible. But between finding the right personnel who have the licenses needed to be able to run them and to be able to pay them a decent wage, finding the money to buy new equipment or to keep equipment in tip-top shape, possibly the amount of money that wastewater utilities would have to spend is in the millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. It's not like you can go down to your corner store and buy the nitrogen processing treatment that you might need. There was a study done by the DRBC by a group called Kleinfelder, and it was billions of dollars for these, the 10 top wastewater treatment centers that produce most of the nitrogen problem. For them to have new systems in place is probably millions of dollars per wastewater utility. Now, there are people who argue with that and say there are cheaper ways. I am not an expert, so I'm not going to try and decide whether there is or there isn't. But it's a significant expenditure. And I think that's you know, that's a problem for everything that a municipality or a city does, whether it's trying to do the right sort of zoning to take care of wetlands and watersheds, pushing back against developers for, because sometimes developers, they have multifamily units and they create water treatment systems that are supposed to take care of those units, and they may or may not be doing a job, and how they go after them and how they legislate them and how they inspect them. I mean, there is a lot of money involved in a wastewater treatment, and a lot of people would prefer our regulations to be more lenient so that they didn't have to spend the money. But I don't want to necessarily whitewash and make all our wastewater treatment people into saints, but generally speaking, most of them are people who want to do a good job and would like to make the water as clean as is possible, but they are limited by how much money they have to spend.
Yeah, perfect example, I think, is what's happening here in the town of Fallsburg in Sullivan County. There's like three or four wastewater treatment plants that have to be updated due to the explosive growth Fallsburg has seen in the past couple of years with communities that can't keep up with the wastewater. So there is a need to upgrade. And I was astounded by the amount of money that has to be spent, you know, multi-million dollars, $23 million on one particular plant. And Fallsburg, the town of Fallsburg, is not a rich town, to be honest with you.
No, absolutely.
And they're struggling of how are we going to pay this without increasing the rates and putting a burden on taxpayers. And, you know, there's a fight between, you know, people yelling that they should stop development and things like that. But eventually, you know, these wastewater treatment plants have a shelf life. They have to be upgraded eventually. And that's the thing. They're just struggling to find the money to they could upgrade and keep up with the standards.
And it often is current occupants versus newer occupants. It becomes a real battle between those two forces. And whether you live up in Fallsburg or down in Philadelphia, the push to further develop our cities and towns will always be there. And I don't know exactly how to pass on, or even if we should pass on, the cost for all of the things that further development brings. It certainly brings costs to our wastewater treatment plants. It brings costs if there's new roads, to how the roads are handled, how the garbage is collected. I mean, there's so many costs in running a sort of a civilized sort of community that we can take for granted. And if you don't have a lot of money in your pocket, you don't want to necessarily see your rates go up. So it's, in a sense, you can think of Fallsburg as a mini Philadelphia. The people in Philadelphia don't have the money for their rates to go up, and it's possibly true that the people in Fallsburg don't have the money to have their rates go up. And this is where, on a tangent a bit, every state has revolving funds. And those revolving funds are ways that big ticket items for communities can often get some help from the state. Sometimes it's in direct grants, although that's getting pretty scarce. Sometimes it's on low interest loans that go over a course of years. Unfortunately, state revolving funds are feeling the pinch with the new administration. So they may not have enough money to be able to meet the needs of the people of the communities that need the help of these low interest loans and revolving funds that these state revolving funds outfits, they're called differently in different states, but they are feeling a bit of the pinch right now. So it's we all want clean water, but we are often reluctant to pay the price tag that it demands. Because to be honest, like just the conversation we've had, God, that is a complicated set of ingredients. And like, who's benefiting? The sturgeon? Who cares, right? Like, if you're worried about keeping a roof over your head and keeping your kids warm in the winter, the fate of the sturgeon is not exactly the top of your list of priorities. But the way we improve our environment is through these very complicated systems and procedures that each one increases what's going on that's good in the environment. And I think it's hard for people to see, in this case, what I would call both sides of a fraught issue.
Right. So where do we go from here? Like, you know, I know that you said in September, late September, there might be a decision to be had from the EPA. But I guess that they still have to listen to the lobbyists from these public utilities.
Well, remember, there are lobbyists on two sides, to be honest. There is certain lobbying from the public utilities, and there's lobbying from the riverkeeper and the other people, environmental groups that are allied to the riverkeeper's hopes for the river. And the thumb on the scales now is the entire setup of the Trump administration, which is to deregulate as much as possible various systems of environmental protection. And right now, what the judge is going to decide on, well, before the judge's decision, it can be that the EPA and the riverkeeper come to an agreement. If they come to an agreement what that figure should be, then the judge doesn't have to do anything. If they can't, this is the lobbying arm of the riverkeeper and company and the EPA, if they can't come to an agreement, then it goes to the judge. So what has happened is the municipal wastewater treatment people have sort of banded together to say, wait a minute, this is our side of the story. They don't really have a specific seat at this table when this figure is going to be announced. So they are pleading with the EPA to consider them as the EPA negotiates what the new standards might be with the riverkeeper.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a complicated issue, and believe me, you explained it well. You know, and the article is written well. Chris did a great job in the article, and it just seems like a battle on all fronts with this administration comes. You know, talking about the EPA, you know, hearing the news on BBC on the way here about what's happening with the CDC here, and it just seems like it's a whole onslaught of rolling back these regulations that were in place for a reason.
Yes. And in almost all these cases, there are actual facts that these decisions are based on. But we are entering the land where facts seem not to matter.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because that when you were talking about how the decision will be made, and it just seems like one person would throw out a number, another person would throw out a number, and it just seems like, why isn't it not just based on the science?
Well, if it was based on the science, we would go with the riverkeeper's number.
Right.
And that would be extraordinarily painful for the communities that would have to find that money.
Yeah.
So that's where the balance is. The science tells us one thing. There is a reality on the ground of communities, you know, much as we talked about Fallsburg, there is a reality of communities on the ground not being able to pay whatever it is that you need to pay in order to get the amount of clean in the water that you would like.
Yeah. Well, Meg, let's leave it there. Like I said, I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon. And you know, we'll talk to Meg McGuire, co-founder and publisher of Delaware Currents, about the latest article, Water Operators Appeal to the Trump Administration for Reprieve to Water Quality Improvement Rules on the Delaware River. In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
And you can read more of Meg McGuire's reporting and the whole team at Delaware Currents at delawarecurrents.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, two friends in their 70s are just days away from completing a cross-country bike ride. Their mission? Raising money for peace in Gaza. This is Radio Chatskill.
Tech CEO Victor Riparbelli says that in the future, AI avatars will be teaching our kids.
Your kids' kids may not read and write. They'll be watching and listening instead.
Hey there, learners.
I'm Professor Cadence Hartman.
I promise I got some interesting stuff, and it's going to take less than 2 minutes for you to learn something cool.
How AI is shaping education. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Ira Flatto from Science Friday. Public media organizations just lost federal funding, and it is a big deal. This cut will have serious long-term consequences for the service we provide to you unless we replace that funding with support from more listeners. The future of public media is in your hands, so please go to the station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today. And thanks.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A 70-year-old man and a friend are nearly finished with a cross-country bike ride they're calling the Ride Against the War in Gaza. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Samantha Simmons reports the pair are riding to raise money to support peace efforts.
Bob Sanders began his ride across the country in San Francisco at the end of May and plans to wrap up this weekend. So far, He says he has raised nearly $20,000 for humanitarian aid and peace. Riding up to Albany's West Capitol Park Thursday on a slim road bike with saddlebags strapped to both sides of the wheel and a paper plastered with a QR code asking for donations, Sanders is wearing a bright yellow cycling jersey with Raw Gaza across the chest. Sanders, who is Jewish, says ideally he would like to raise $1 for every confirmed death as a result of the war. A former journalist, Sanders says he wasn't allowed to share his opinions on the conflict, but now he feels it's time.
I was active before I was a reporter, and I kind of avoided this issue. And even with family and friends, I basically ducked it because it was uncomfortable, and I didn't want to believe that a Jewish nation would be complicit, would be perpetuating genocide.
Yeah. More than 62,000 people have died since Hamas attacked Israel and killed about 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped another 250 civilians and soldiers on October 7th, 2023. Since then, more than 60,000 Gazans have been killed in Israel's response to the initial attack. Sanders described the war as genocide, a position contested by the American Jewish Committee, among other groups. Nearly 3,000 miles into his journey, Sanders says he has experienced boundless love. He says he packed a tent for the journey that he carries on the back of his bike, but has only used it once. He has been staying with cyclists who put up other cyclists doing long-haul rides. He recently stayed with an apolitical Mormon family.
They asked, well, why are you doing this? I hear that Hamas is terrorist and so forth. And that was after several days. They wouldn't talk about it. And they said, you know, and I told them, and they pretty much agreed with me. Because at that time, they took the time to get to know me. And I wasn't some political person waving a flag. I was a human being.
Sanders says he's not what some may call a Hamas fanatic. He just disagrees with the Israeli government's approach to peace. Along the journey, Sanders has stopped to join protest vigils and other events protesting the war. He says he hopes people will learn from history and speak out against further harm against other Jewish people.
They take away that it's not anti-Semitic to criticize Israel.
Also riding with Sanders is Naor Delanu. Delanu joined Sanders shortly after he began his trek across the country. 32-year-old Delanu says he has family in Israel, including a cousin who was close to a bomb drop.
When you're talking to people in real life, it's definitely, I think, more humanizing than internet, than arguing with people online. And I think that, yeah, that's, I think that we'll, I'm not super hopeful about the near future, but I do hope that the policy eventually catches up to public opinion here, and that public opinion in Israel-Palestine is not forever so dehumanizing.
He says the U.S.'s financial support of Israel is contributing to further escalations of the conflict. In March, the Trump administration signed an emergency declaration expediting the issuance of $4 billion in military assistance to Israel, according to the Department of State. Since January, Trump's administration has approved nearly $12 billion in foreign military aid to Israel. In a meeting Wednesday with Israel's foreign minister, Gideon Sa'ar, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, quote, reaffirmed the United States' unwavering commitment to Israel's security, unquote. The U.S. has given a fraction of that level of financial support to Palestine over many decades. Sanders and Delanu will bike to Western Massachusetts in the coming days and wrap up the trip in Concord, New Hampshire over the long weekend. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Samantha Simmons.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the latest episode of Curtain Call, our theater podcast, drops today. We'll have a preview next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table.
This week, we talk summer cooking, including, yes, how to feed everyone while on vacation, with award-winning cookbook author Carla Lally Music. And we dive into the sweet shaved ices of Asia with Food & Wine's Khushbu Shah. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The latest episode of Curtain Call, hosted by Tom Candela, is out today. That's our theater podcast. And Tom is here to give us a preview, an excerpt of your conversation with a big name in theater, five-time Emmy-nominated playwright, screenwriter, Douglas Carter Bean.
Yes, and Tony-nominated as
Tony
well.
Tony-nominated, yes, sorry, yes.
Douglas Carter Bean. He's done such plays as Xanadu, Sister Act. Everybody knows Sister Act. In fact, Forsberg Play, not Forsberg Play, that's one of our companies around here, did Sister Act recently.
Yeah.
In our area. The Little Dog Laughed is another one. And his most recent work is Finding Dorothy Parker. Mm. And I didn't know anything about this woman, I have to admit. You know, in doing my research, I learned a lot. And certainly in speaking with Douglas, I learned a whole lot about her. But she was an incredible critic, a poet, an essayist. And she had these barbs and witticisms that she was probably one of the most quoted women yes. In her time in the early 20th century, and one of the founders of the Algonquin Round Table.
Yes.
Which is something I didn't really know about. So I learned a lot.
Learned a lot, and we're going to learn some too. It's the latest episode of Curtain Call. The full episode is available at wjffradio.org. But here is a preview, an excerpt of Tom's conversation with Douglas Carter Bean. Tony-nominated playwright, not Emmy.
Today we're going to be focusing on Dorothy Parker. She was a poet, critic, satirist, and a founding voice of the Algonquin Round Table. And bringing her voice back to the stage is none other than Douglas Carter Bean. He's one of the most celebrated playwrights of our era, with Tony nominations for works like The Little Dog Laughed, Xanadu, and his sparkling reimagining of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. Bean has now turned his attention to Dorothy Parker in his new work, Finding Dorothy Parker, featuring a stellar cast, including Julie Halston, Anne Harada, Jackie Hoffman, and Anika Larsson. The show captures Parker's wit, resilience, and humanity in a theatrical celebration of her works. Douglas, I want to welcome you to Curtain Call.
Well, it's great to be here. That's a glowing introduction, I must say.
Great. So, Doug, basically, I'm going to start pretty much at the beginning. What was it about Dorothy Parker, her voice, her work, that made you say, this needs to be on the stage?
Well, it was a long time of brewing, let me tell you.
Uh-huh.
I was in high school at Wyomissing Area High School, and in the library. They had a collection of her work, and I read it, and I immediately connected with it. I loved her. I devoured everything I could find by her. And that became a lifelong quest, and that led me to reading plays and really following a life, turning into the life of a playwright from that little moment in a library.
Okay.
And then, as fate would have it, the spring play that year at my high school was a George Kaufman play. And then it was done. I was a theater person from then on. So there are many writers, James Baldwin, John Powell, many writers that I just, Noel Coward, where if I see something by them, I grab it. I have to read it. I have to know everything they've done. Because being a writer is so lonely, you're looking for somebody else to be with you in the room.
Yeah.
And every play I write, I tend to have an imaginary collaborator with me just so that they're there so I can maybe think like they do a little bit. And so then came COVID, that kooky, nutty COVID time, and I began to read Dorothy stuff just as a comfort. And they're fantastic. They're just the best writing, some of the best American writing you'll find. So I thought, why don't I just get on Zoom? And so I found some spectacular actresses that we'd get on Zoom, and we read them. And it's, I thought maybe there's an evening here of this, or maybe there's a story where I put them all together and right. These women all meet, and I don't know what to do with it. And then I just found more for writing, which I just said, let's just get together and have women read her theater reviews. Let's have women read her literary reviews. Let's have her do her poems. So I just said, this is a show here. And then when COVID was over, we formed. It was about six actresses and I got together. And then as the material coalesced, it became good for four actresses. And then I invited some people to the Players in New York, which is a private club for theater folk.
Okay.
And we read through it in front of an audience, and they went ballistic. People were screaming. They couldn't. And they said, oh, my God. And the show then was called What Fresh Hell Is This?, which is famously how Dorothy Parker would answer her telephone. So I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. I'm on the board of directors. And I put together, and I said, and I showed them the Dorothy Parker stuff. And they loved her, and they were enamored of her. They wanted to know more about her. And then at the end of the Q&A, I just said, how many of you had heard of Dorothy Parker before we did this? And only one person raised their hand. So that's where the title Finding Dorothy Parker came from.
Okay.
I just said, let's find her. Let's excavate the material. Let's find her.
So you spoke a little bit about she had a vast collection of works, right? You mentioned her poems,
yes.
Short stories, witticisms. Out of all of that, how did you decide what goes in and what stays out?
I wanted the stuff that would connect immediately with a person today.
Okay.
That was the criterion. So it was the stuff that connected now. And I think that it's relevant. I think that she was a woman who was blacklisted for being too left-wing. Mm. She was a founder of the Screenwriters Union. She was a good union person. She was an artist who wasn't afraid to call out corruption when it was happening. And I think that's heroic right now.
So how do you make it resonate now with today's audiences, her work?
Well, as I said, the selection of material, doing it in a bar, which the Doris Laurie Beachman Theater very much is. It's kind of a speakeasy feeling.
Okay.
It's on 42nd Street. It's not on the Upper East Side. I work a lot in London, and there is a DJ named Alistair Rowe who does a lot of raves in the London dance scene. And I happened to have heard some of his music, and then I saw him dance and perform. And I went up to him and I said, if I brought you 20s jazz music, could you deconstruct it and put it through your blender and make it sound like contemporary dance music? Mm-hmm. And he was like, absolutely. So we did it. So we have this very contemporary music but with an old vibe to it going so that a young person would feel comfortable and not out of the loop.
Right.
So now we're doing it for the first time in the bar.
Okay.
At the Laurie Beachman down in the basement of the West Bank on 42nd Street.
Okay.
And then we'll see how it goes. We'll take it from there. It seems like, does it want to be in a theater? Does it want to be in a bar? Does it want to be in a speakeasy? We'll find out.
But I'm sure there are things in her work that parallels today's cultural climate. And I'm sure you found
Absolutely.
Some of that, right? And some of her witticisms, one of them I found that I think was probably one of her most famous. This is when someone told her that Calvin Coolidge had died. She said, how could you tell? And I mean, I guess people could correlate that to today. I mean, they could use that on any number of our politicians.
A little too active, our current president. A little too active for my taste, but there you are.
So now you brought in these great actresses to this project. Are you encouraging them in your direction to channel Parker herself, or you want them more to interpret the words in their own voices?
Visually, they're dressed basic black string of pearls, and then they have different colored ribbons on their wrists. And this was a tribute to Dorothy Parker. Whenever she would attempt suicide, she would immediately be filled with regret and then cover her wrists with brightly colored ribbon as if to say, I'm coming back. I'm going to be great again. But I encourage them to be as honest and truthful as the material will allow us to be, which is pretty great.
How has the rehearsals been going for you as the director?
It's been great. I watch them and I'm amazed and I guide them when I can towards bigger and greater things. But they knock me out every time. I'm absolutely amazed by them.
Now, Parker, she was quite famous for her sharpness, but also for vulnerability beneath her humor. And if she were alive today and looking at the show, what do you think she'd say about this production of what you've collected?
I think Dorothy Parker alive today, the first thing she would say was, well, I'm not wearing that. She was also known for being a great clothes horse.
But you think that she would be impressed with what her own body of work and how it's being presented?
Well, I think she always hated her own body of work.
Did she?
I think that she never had the Pulitzer Prize winning novel or Tony Award winning play. And I think that ate her up. I think she was, she read extensively and knew what great work was. And she herself never quite did that. So in this show, why I said Finding Dorothy Parker's, we may know expressions she said here or there, mm-hmm. or a turn of phrase, but we don't know her work. And so I wanted that to happen. But I also wanted to show it in a way that it felt like a complete, like, oh, there's a lot here, because there is a lot there, but it's just not contained in one novel. She never had a Great Gatsby. She never had a Sound of the Fury. She never had a great sweeping novels. But she was wonderful at critiquing them.
So how do you modernize that to get audiences to connect with it?
You don't. Her work is too modern.
Okay.
Her work is, she's already a step ahead. She is a woman seeing the world as it is and summing it up succinctly. And that is irresistible to young women everywhere. But no, we don't touch the actual material at all.
Okay. So you spoke a little bit about her activism, politically involved in civil rights, anti-fascism. Are there moments in the show that will highlight some of that as well?
Yeah, we found the NAACP was very helpful in connecting us with some of her speeches,
mm-hmm.
some of her articles that she wrote in left-wing newspapers. They're great. I mean, from the 30s all the way up to the 50s, it's really great stuff. And it's all in there.
In this particular production, you chose to be both the playwright and the director. How and when do you decide to wear both hats? What made you say, as opposed to just playwriting it, that you said, no, I also have to direct it? What's the process there for you?
Well, I knew that I was someone who could do it, who was good at it, mm-hmm. who knew this style and knew how to talk to actresses about this. Also, I didn't write it. Dorothy Parker wrote it. I just sort of shaped it. This is a type of directing where you just sort of shape everything and create it and formulate it.
Okay. I want to make sure we mention where and when this is playing. Yes.
And so, at the gorgeous Laurie Beachman Theater. And when I say gorgeous, I am not lying.
Okay.
It may be in the basement on 42nd Street, but it is beautifully designed by David Rockwell. It's a stunner of a room. And it is being done by the four best comedic actresses Broadway's got to offer. So it's on at the September 2nd, 3rd, and 4th at 7 o'clock on 42nd Street at the West Bank Cafe in the basement, the Laurie Beachman Theater. And I can guarantee you're going to laugh.
Well, thank you so much, Doug. I do appreciate you taking the time out of your very busy schedule to spend time on Curtain Call.
It was great talking to you, sir.
And what a fun and fascinating conversation that was with Douglas Carter Bean as we explored Dorothy Parker's razor-sharp wit, her legacy, and how Douglas has brought her voice to life for today's audiences. The show runs September 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. I know it's a very limited run, and it's coming up really soon, but you know, it is what it is. And it's playing over at the Laurie Beachman Theater, located at 407 West 42nd Street, Manhattan's Hell's Kitchen. And tickets are available online at thebeachman.com. So that's thebeachman.com. And you'll also find all the show times and seating information on that site.
And thanks to Tom Candela. That's from Curtain Call, our podcast about theater, and a new episode drops every Friday. You can hear the extended conversation and all of the podcast episodes at our website, wjffradio.org. And you're listening to Radio Chatskill. And before we go, the Wayne County Arts Alliance is celebrating the opening of a new dual exhibit, Atmosphere, a collection of work by artists Deborah Housing and Paul Plumador's Waves. It opens with a reception this evening at 5 and runs through October 4th. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi sat down with Deborah Housing to talk about her inspiration and process behind Atmosphere.
Good morning, Deborah Housing, and welcome to WJFF's Radio Chatskill.
Thanks so much, Valerie. I'm happy to be here.
You have a show coming up, an exhibit at the Wayne County Arts Alliance coming up over this Labor Day weekend. What can you tell us about what we're going to see?
Right. So my exhibition is called Atmosphere, and it is a collection of oil, gouache, and acrylic paintings. There's some graphite and colored pencil drawings, and I'm also going to have prints available. And the work will be shown in the members gallery on the second floor of the Wayne County Art Alliance Gallery, and that's at 959 Main Street in Homesdale. The exhibition runs August 28th through October 4th, and there's an open artist reception. That's next Friday, August 29th from 5 to 8 p.m. So the term atmosphere in the case of this exhibition kind of refers to a mood or a feeling, and I hope that people walk away from the show feeling something, and really that's my goal.
Can you tell us a little bit about your art training and your experience in the arts?
So I do have some formal training, but I feel like I'm largely self-taught. I did attend Kutztown University as a communication design major, and that degree focused on illustration, graphics, and design. But, you know, sometimes life doesn't go according to plan, so I took a detour and I ended up in IT and cybersecurity. But at this point, I'm returning to my roots, and over the past 5 years, I've been actively painting and creating in my home studio. But for me, art has been kind of a lifelong pursuit, and I just really feel driven to paint and create. My work's been seen in a variety of area galleries and exhibitions. The Wayne County Art Alliance each year promotes something called the Great Wall of Homesdale. And in 2022, I was a selected artist, and I had one of my pieces of artwork put up on display in Homesdale, and that was pretty cool. In 2024, I was a selected banner artist for Paint the Town in Holly. And I've been seen in the Wayne County Art Alliance Gallery Line of Sight exhibition at a solo art show this spring at B. Madigan's Jewelry and Gifts in Holly. And I was a featured artist in the Lake Wall Paw Pack Neighbors magazine this spring. So up next is the Atmosphere exhibition, and I'm pretty excited about that.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
I just wanted to say that I'm really grateful for the tremendous amount of support for the arts in the local community. The Wayne County Art Alliance is always offering interesting opportunities to emerging artists like me, but also for more established artists. And I really like that connection to the community. And I think that they do that really well. And so I just wanted to express my appreciation for those opportunities.
Yes, there's much to appreciate here. Thank you so much again, Deborah.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Reminder, lots of Radio Catskill events this weekend starting today. Putt Putt for Public Radio in Bovina. Tomorrow, the Music Yard Sale. And on Sunday, Pints for Public Radio at the Catskill Brewery. Get all the details. Come see us. It's at wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from
North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, NACL.org, and from listeners like you.
I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. We might see a couple of showers into the early afternoon, then clearing up, high 65, tonight's low 44. For the weekend, mostly sunny and pleasant, high 66 Saturday, 69 Sunday, 72 Monday.